My hope for my kids, my hope for my friends, my hope for anybody listening to this is that they can find that thing that expresses who they want to be much more than who they want to impress. And anybody who is who they want to be is impressive. I don't care what you're good at. I don't care what you chase. I don't care what your goals are. If you do it, regardless of what I think about those goals with respect to my life, that doesn't mean anything. I care. I'm impressed. I am happy to co-celebrate that kind of achievement when somebody not only identifies what they want to be and what they want to do, but they achieve it and they live through that journey.
Yo, 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 what is going on, everybody? This is your boy Los Carlos with the Motor Misfit. Guys, I am so excited about today's episode. This is somebody that I've been wanting on the show for such a long time just because I watch their YouTube channel. I love their app and quite honestly, all the new things that he and his organization, his company, his friends are doing is amazing. Today we have on Ed Bolian, the CEO, founder of VinWiki. If you don't know what VinWiki is, definitely go on, check it out. They are on YouTube, but VinWiki is also an app. So you will see in this episode, but it is an amazing episode, guys. Ed takes us through his journey, gives us advice, gives us so much insight. And you know what? It happened at a good time because they just released a series called Car Trekked, and they're on their fourth season. So definitely check that out as well. I don't want to talk too much, but I'm just so excited. And you know what? Let's get into the episode so that you guys can see it for yourself. Yo, 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 what is going on, everybody? This is your boy, Los Carlos, with the Motor Misfit. Guys, I am so excited for this guest today. Today, we are talking with the Lamborghini enthusiast, master storyteller, and CEO / co-founder of VinWiki, Ed Bolian. What is going on, Ed?
You know, another day. Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome, man. Yep, another day, another dollar, right? But we definitely appreciate you getting on, so thank you for taking some time to talk with us today.
My pleasure. What do you want to talk about?
Well, we want to go through your journey, but I want to introduce you first. Everybody should know who you are, especially if they're on YouTube, if they're into exotics, if they're into cannonball, if they're into Lamborghini, they should all know who you are. But let's do a short little intro and then I'll pass it on over to you.
Sounds good.
So Ed has been a car enthusiast his entire life. At an early age, he aspired to be an auto journalist and stepped into that arena when forming his own exotic car rental company in Atlanta, to then selling Lamborghinis and other exotic vehicles at a well-known supercar dealership. In 2013, he set the world record for the Cannonball Run and then soon after co-founded VinWiki, a social media car history platform. Today, Ed will take us through his amazing journey and provide us with some great advice and insight. I'll pass it on over to him and he can share a little bit more about himself.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up loving cars and the idea of what a dream car was, how it could motivate us through life, how it could help me make better decisions. And, you know, certainly the journeys and things that I could take them on. And so I started to, you know, really try to formulate a life plan, a career path that would lead me to that. And, you know, back in 2006, I was a sophomore in college and I was looking for, you know, an entrepreneurial project. And at that time, the exotic car rental space wasn't terribly built out, particularly in kind of second tier cities that weren't Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Miami, New York. And so Atlanta certainly was one of those that, you know, there was a market for sure, but it was very much untapped and unexplored. And so I started that with a huge loan for my first Lamborghini. And that was 20 years old and sort of the rest became history. We grew the company a little bit and eventually I kind of decided that I wanted to try something else. And sold that off and did okay, and then went on to sell exotic cars at Motor Cars of Georgia. We were a Lamborghini, Aston Martin, McLaren, and Lotus dealership, and I certainly fell in love even more with the Lamborghini brand. Growing up, I would have said I was probably more of a Ferrari enthusiast, but the Murcielago was really the dream car, and so it's been fun to chase after those, and now I've owned six of them. So worked there at the dealership for about 6 years and just kind of left looking for the next project. I have a reasonably short attention span, and I'd probably even outrun it by a couple of years at that point. And so just started the process of meeting with some friends, exploring ideas, and the idea of a social vehicle history reporting platform, kind of like a crowdsourced version of Carfax, became what we wanted to work on. And so some friends of mine that had different development skill sets and I, we all sat around in my living room or a coffee shop at different times and just spitballed ideas of how that might come together. And after, I think, 47 different revisions of the app, we released it to the public in the summer of 2016. And so it started to grow a bit, but not a ton, to be quite honest. You always think that when you release a hot new app into the world, you're just going to tap a domino and the world's going to love it and it's going to become the next Facebook. And that was not any really the expectation, but it certainly was not the reality we found. And so we needed to find different ways to economically market. And one of those became YouTube. And so I thought, you know, we'd seen some pretty good conversion when some friends of mine that had larger YouTube channels would come and drive my cars and mention VinWiki. We'd get a lot of downloads. And so I knew that converting YouTube viewers into app downloaders was certainly a possibility. And so we just decided to lean into that a little bit more. And so I got a bunch of pizza and a bunch of beer, and we just sat around my warehouse telling our best car stories. And a friend of mine from church recorded and edited them. And so we shot the first 25 VinWiki car stories in a day.
Oh, wow.
And then just kind of put them out there, not knowing if we'd ever accumulate our own audience or anything like that at the time. You know, there were some up-and-coming YouTubers. I think DeMuro had probably just passed 100,000 subscribers. Freddie was coming up not far behind him. And, you know, Tyler Hoover was starting his channel. And so it was just a very interesting time. And obviously a lot of those guys have become much more good friends of mine. We've worked on other projects. And so, yeah, that was kind of the cart driving the horse at that point, because I kind of accidentally adopted the job of making car videos for the internet. And now we've released a little over 1,000 videos and have about 450 million views, 1.4 million subscribers. And it's been an absolute blast. Like I said, I never intended for that. It just kind of became the marketing avenue, not designed to be super branded for the app. You know, we've steadily grown. We're about to hit 400,000 downloads on the app, which is great. People are really inputting a lot of data. They're using our features that allow them to like tie cars together. So we've got almost 4 billion connections between cars that our users have created through lists of like rare car registries and, you know, unique cars they like, cars they've owned, cars they've worked on at their shop, cars they've detailed. So it's a very interesting way to kind of consume data through the app and to see different ways that people are tied to cars. And that's really what the YouTube channel was designed to be. And these car stories being examples of the type of content that we'd like people to add to the social timeline of a car that appears in the app. And so, yeah, it's been a whole lot of fun and certainly unexpected, but I'm very, very grateful to have, you know, kind of accumulated the platform and to be able to tell our best stories.
Awesome, man. No, and to tell you the truth, I didn't know. The way I found VinWiki was through YouTube, right? So It was a great idea to market that way. And quite honestly, I don't have a supercar, right? But I even downloaded the VinWiki app, got on there, started. I have a Civic Type R, and at that point, I think I had a black Civic Type R. Now I have a white one. But I put up the black Civic Type R that I had there, and I was like, all right, let me share some information on this black Civic Type R. And I'm like, yeah, it might not work for this. But I'm on there either way.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, it's obviously in its infancy still, even, you know, 5 years in terms of the data that's going to be in there. Obviously, we have, thousands and thousands of posts each day. But the reality is, like, it's based on a lot of things that I did in selling cars. And it really learning that the way that I could curate the history of a car allowed me to change a prospective buyer's perception of it much more than they might be influenced by a Carfax or an auto check. And so what I wanted to be able to do was to give somebody a voice, give somebody a place where they could put information about a car they knew something about, nice, not nice, cheap, expensive, supercar, slow car, doesn't matter, so that it could be, you know, a great way for people to, you know, find that information in the future. I used to make it a habit of putting all the VINs of all the cars that I had owned on my personal website so that they were easy to Google. So if somebody buys a car and Googles their VIN, they find me. And I thought it was fascinating to find out where my old cars had ended up, what had happened to them, if they'd been crashed, lost, rebuilt, shipped overseas, all these things. And I learned a lot of fun stuff that way. And so this was very much designed to be a way to connect to you more broadly to the cars that you own or know something about.
Yeah, no, and that's awesome. And it's a great idea, to tell you the truth. And especially if, like, obviously, if you're a car enthusiast and you go and you buy, you purchase a vehicle from a private party, right? You want to know the history of this car. There's so many things that could go wrong throughout the history. For example, I bought my wife a Infiniti GX80, I believe, that big truck that they have. And yeah, we bought it from a dealership, and it's like, oh, the Carfax came out great, VIN checker came out great. And then it wasn't until a few weeks later that we noticed that, the VIN really isn't that great on this car. Like, this car has had issues. Like, for example, it came over from the Cayman Islands, was probably a flood car at some point, and that could have all been avoided if, you know, this would have been like on VinWiki or some kind of platform like that, so that you're able to see the history on the car. So it's an amazing idea, because some of these, well, most of these apps right there, that are out right now, or platforms that are out right now, don't give you the full story. They just give you whatever the dealership or whoever owns the car wants to put in there at that time, you know?
Yeah, totally. You're limited by the institutional data that Carfax and AutoCheck rely on. And so being able to dig in a little bit deeper, gives you a lot of power.
Yeah, definitely. So it is an awesome idea. So I applaud you guys for actually coming up with this, and definitely on the bandwagon to be able to get more people using it, because it definitely is needed. Like me, I told you, I'm getting in. I have a Civic Type R. It's my second Civic Type R, but I want to delve into the world of other vehicles, Porsches. Someday aspire to own a Lamborghini. And for people like me and for others out there, this would be a perfect app to be able to see that car history. So definitely applaud you guys for coming up with this idea and executing on it.
Thanks so much. So what's your dream car?
So I'm a Lamborghini Huracan lover. I love Huracans. I would say a Huracan and a Ferrari 488 GT, because I was always a Lamborghini fan, always. Like, growing up, I had Lamborghini posters everywhere, Lamborghini, Lamborghini, Lamborghini. It wasn't until I actually drove a Lamborghini Huracan and I was able to side-by-side drive a 488 Italia, I believe. And I got to say, I actually like the Italia, how the Italia drove a little bit better. Sure. Not kind of turning my back on Lamborghini, but I still am going after the Lamborghini Huracan. But, you know, I did like how that Ferrari drove. So, yes, Lamborghini Huracan all the way. And I know that you're a Murcielago fan. You love your LP640. So I know you're a straight-up Lamborghini lover enthusiast as well.
That I am. But that's the great thing about the world of high-performance cars now, is that there are so many choices that as you explore them, as you test drive them, it's easier to find something that truly does fit exactly the way that you want to own and use a car. So that's exciting, man.
Yeah, definitely, man. So let's kind of touch on that a little bit. Let's go back a little. So I know that you've been into cars. So how did you kind of touched on it a little bit at the beginning. You know, you saw that there was a need in the marketplace for, secondary cities, for car, exotic car rentals. So how did you just, you know, wake up one day and was like, you know, I want to start a car rental company? Or how did you go along just executing that idea and actually turning it into a business for yourself and actually a profitable business for yourself.
Sure. So it did not happen overnight. You know, I explored a lot of different ways to potentially raise the money. I didn't have a trust fund to dip into or anything like that. And I'm not sure that would ever be the right way to use a trust fund if you had one. But I knew that the idea had some legs, and I knew that it fit with a lot of the passions that I had. And I wanted to make sure that I, you know, understood the market as well as one could. So I did a lot of research about how contracts were written for the other companies that were doing it, how insurance was going to work, what financing was actually viable, and then what I was going to be able to do from, you know, adding to my skill sets and the things that I could learn. And so it was a long process. It probably took me 4 or 5 years really between recognizing this as something that the Atlanta market might benefit from and actually being able to find and buy a car. And then, of course, I didn't start with a fleet of cars. I started with one. I made it look on the internet like I had more cars, but they were always booked until I was able to buy them. And so started with just a 2004 Gallardo, added a Ferrari 360 about 6 months later. Another one, that first one was a coupe, added a Spider about 6 months after that. And just kind of kept it lean, kept it small, but kept it growing. And, you know, it's nice when you see these fleet pictures of a dozen interesting cars all in a warehouse somewhere, but the day that you took that picture, you didn't make any money. And so I learned very quickly that, you know, with 3 or 4 cars rented out quickly and well and often, then that was really about all that the Atlanta market needed, to be quite honest. And so there weren't a lot of days where I needed to have 10 cars because they wouldn't have all been out. So, yeah. You know, maybe it would have been nice for some of the customers to have a little bit more diversity, but I couldn't buy them. And so this was a very different time in terms of the auto lending climate. And that, you know, I knew that certainly that they were giving stated income loans. People with no loan experience were able to get loans like that. Interest rates were higher. I mean, you were paying 6, 7, 8, 9% for a car loan at that time. Very different than what we saw, you know, just 5 or 10 years later. But it was a very interesting business. I had a whole lot of fun. I learned a lot about what it's like to be a solo entrepreneur and the risks that you're taking and a little bit of how to manage those risks. But I had a ton of fun and, you know, it was a very good experience.
That's awesome, man. And I heard a story. Actually, I saw it on VinWiki. So you already know my source.
It's very reliable.
Yes, exactly. I believe it was you telling the story about how you basically lived in the warehouse where you kept the cars.
I did.
So, I mean, that's a way to cut down on your costs, right?
Well, that's the thing. You know, people think of this idea of being an entrepreneur as being this sexy, awesome job. And it's not, to be quite honest, because you go into business on your own because there is some job that you think that is. And it probably is that job, but it also is being the accountant, being the janitor, being the security, being the risk adjuster. All the things that need to be done in order to keep a business afloat have nothing to do with the fact that you like marketing the idea of short-term rentals in some of the coolest cars on earth to a customer base in a market that hasn't heard of that before. Like, that's what I wanted to do, but what I ended up having to do was everything else. And I had no idea what that was. I didn't know how to keep books for a business. I didn't know how to prepare a tax return. I didn't know how to do all that stuff, but I had to learn. And that meant that I had to really cut costs. And I would say, of all the things that I learned about cars through the rental car company, the most valuable thing was how to truly understand cost of ownership. And so I knew that every mile that a Gallardo or a 360 got driven was going to ultimately cost me about $5.70. And as long as I could net more than that, I knew I was really making money. Now, sometimes, you know, obviously that's not, they don't bill you every mile. They bill you in big chunks when things break. And you can anticipate when things are going to break. And we did a good job of that. But at the same time, you don't just sit around with a lot of extra cash there. And so avoiding spending it when you possibly can was really, really important. And so, yeah, after I graduated from college, I moved out of an apartment where we had 6 different roommates and we're putting the cheapest part of Atlanta, but certainly not the place where I could park any cars, and got a warehouse kind of on the north side of Atlanta, and ended up living there. That was certainly not in the zoning agreement or the rental agreement, but it was all I could afford. And it was honestly some of the best living you ever had. It was quiet, everybody kept, you know, there was nobody else there in the middle of the night, obviously, because they weren't allowed to. And yeah, apart from the occasional coyote howling, it was a wonderful, wonderful time.
You had coyote neighbors.
Sometimes.
No, man, but that's awesome, man. I mean, that shows right there like a true businessman. Like the fact that, and I know that you had a non-car related business before that, like you're into reptiles, right?
I am. Yeah. Before I wanted to be Jeremy Clarkson, I wanted to be the crocodile hunter. And so I had a business breeding albino iguanas in my parents' basement in middle and early high school.
Oh, wow, man.
Yeah.
Crazy. So even from before, you were a businessman. So it's cool how you were able to teach yourself, like even down to the specifics. Okay, this car, like you said, it's going to cost me $5 and some change to be able to rent this out a day. And as long as I'm making more money than that, I'm in the clear, right? So to be able to get it down to the science to that, man, like that is amazing. Not coming from that type of business before or even working in that before, that's great that you were able to do that. So it really takes some smart, man, some smarts, let's say.
Some bad risks that just didn't manifest.
Hey, that is the best lesson, right? Some things that didn't go your way, and then you're able to learn from them.
That's right.
Exactly. So
what do you do other than to be a podcaster?
So me, I'm into technology sales. So,
excellent.
That's my regular 9-to-5. To tell you the truth, I've always tried to get into the car business, into the car industry, right? And I even had aspirations to, you know, have my own rental car fleet at some point. I lived in Boston before moving down here to South Florida. So, yeah, that definitely was a dream of mine, along with some other things. It just never panned out. So it's those failed attempts of mine that have made me actually, have drove me to this podcast, right? Because, and I say this story, and I've said this story in a few other episodes, when I was younger, like all you could really be was a mechanic, right? Where I'm from, we didn't know anything else. You're either a mechanic or a car salesman. That's it.
Sure.
Right? But there's so many opportunities out there, and people just don't know that about them. They know they love cars, they are enthusiasts, they want to be in this field, in this industry, and they just don't have the knowledge. So that's kind of what drove me to this podcast. It's like, hey, if I can get this information out there, see what else you could get into and still have your passion for cars and turn it into your career, then you know what? It might be a little too late for me because I already have a career somewhere else, although I would love to get back into the car industry. But if I could help somebody else get there and, you know, follow their passion, follow their dreams, then you know what? That makes me happy and that fulfills me at night. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah, totally.
That definitely is this podcast is a passion project of mine. So back to you though. From the exotic car rental, then you started selling exotic cars at Motorsports Atlanta. Do I have that right?
Motor Cars of Atlanta, yeah.
Motor Cars, sorry.
Obviously, I was a client of most of the exotic car dealerships around Atlanta. And as the economy weakened in 2008 and into 2009, it became really, really hard to sell anything, much less luxury and, you know, supercar assets. And so they were really struggling to pitch the value proposition to buyers who could sort of watch the cars depreciate in front of them. And so they really needed somebody with a firmer grasp on the true economics of ownership to sell around what was unavoidable, kind of the elephant in the room. And so I'd been sort of courted by the local Ferrari dealership and the local Lamborghini dealership. But even at that time, you know, 08, 09, that was the time of the 599 and the Scuderia. Ferraris were still pretty easy to sell from a new car perspective. Used cars, not as easy, but no new exotic or no new Ferrari dealers do that much of a used business. And so I knew it was harder to sell Lamborghinis. And so I decided to take them up on their offer rather than the brand that I was probably at that point a little bit more interested in at Ferrari. And so I, you know, kind of went over there to see what it was like. And, you know, that's the thing, like you said, there's when somebody says, I want to work in the car business, like that is not enough. I mean, that would be like, you know, I want to work in food. Yeah. And you know, it's that kind of a genre. I mean, that could mean that you're a waiter. It could mean that you're a chef. It could mean that you're a restaurateur. It could mean that you sell food to prisons. There's so many different things that you can do in food. So in the same way, you can work for a dealership, you can work for a manufacturer, you can work for a vendor, a detailer, a clear bra guy, a tire store, you can be a test driver for a company, you can be a promotional marketing guy for a company. There's so many things. You can run an app about cars, you can make a YouTube channel or a podcast about cars. There's so many more facets to the idea of employment within the automotive space that people disregard or that, like you say, they just don't know. Yeah. And I think this was a situation where I was given an opportunity to work in the dealership world. And I'd always thought, hey, maybe one day I might like to have a car dealership. That seemed like a good idea. It seems to afford you some privileges. And I learned very quickly that no, I did not want to own the dealership. I did not want to incur all those risks and expenses. I just wanted to sell cars. I enjoyed negotiating. I enjoyed, you know, explaining to someone how a car might fit or didn't fit into what they were looking for, and to kind of offer clarity there and guidance as somebody who could kind of counsel them through the decisions they were making. And so that was a really, really useful time. And I learned a ton, because you see behind the curtain and you see how it works and you see who's doing what to the cars. And yeah, like you say, it's a lot more than a salesman and a mechanic. You know, there's a lot more people that go into fundamentally even just the transaction of a car. And so, yeah, I became probably the number one Lamborghini salesman in the US, maybe even the world at times. And we sold a ton of cars, made a lot of people really happy, learned how to do that even in an entrepreneurial way within the confines of a dealership, because you still have to build your own book of business. You still got to make sure that you're adding value before, during, and after a transaction. And it's all about, you know, conveying an idea, convincing somebody of what you want them to do, and then making them feel like it was their idea in the first place.
It's so true what you're saying, man. I mean, there's a lot more out there for people to get into. And when you say that you want to be in the car business or in the car industry, you know, that's such a broad statement. And you really need to narrow it down to see what it is that you like and then go after it. So in 2013, you just had this idea to do Cannonball. How did come along?
I mean, that came along because I was, as a burgeoning car enthusiast, I was reading all the magazines. I was seeing all the shootouts and the Nürburgring lap times and the 0-60 and quarter mile and all the things that the magazines go to in order to market cars to you on behalf of the manufacturers that are letting them drive their cars. And so I kind of got not tired of it, because I was going to read every one they put out. But at the same time, I just realized, like, I want to know what a car would do along the route of my house to grandma's in Florida, like, you know, 500-600 miles. What could I drive there that, you know, the fastest? And, you know, you started to see things like these Top Gear, you know, public transit versus supercar contest. I'm like, that is awesome. You know, what would be really cool is if they put all the best cars and all the best drivers on one coast, and then they race to the other coast. Like, that I would watch. And my dad heard me say that, and he said, oh yeah, Cannonball, that sounds like you. And it was the first I'd heard of it. I was sometime in high school, and I, of course, go into massive research mode and learned it was a real thing they did in the 70s, and something that, you know, was still somewhat being continued today in different forms. And there was the Gumball 3000 and the One Lap of America, but not really like a cross-country race. And so I started planning the idea of what that might look like in a modern context back as a high schooler, you know, 2003, 2004, 2005. And I just decided, you know, one day that was my goal. I thought that it was the manifestation of a lot of the things, the skills, the ideas about myself that I would like to be able to express. And it seemed like a great test. It didn't seem like something that was maybe even possible, but you know, it certainly seemed like something that on the other side of it might be pretty defining about who you wanted to be with respect to cars. And I think that when we think about the jobs we want, with the ideas we want people to think when they think about us, the ways that we do want to define ourselves to the world, particularly narrowing it into the genre that we care about, there's usually some abstract or more roundabout way to achieve what it is you think you want to be than to go the straight route that everybody assumes. You know, we've seen examples in every kind of industry and every kind of genre of somebody who enters it from an entirely different perspective. Elon Musk has the most valuable car company on earth, not because he knows a thing about cars, but because he came at it from a different angle. And that doesn't mean he's right, doesn't mean he's wrong. It just means that he did it differently. We've seen international players come into the NBA who are 10 years older than anybody else on their team and developed fundamentals in an entirely different way, but they're still on the same roster. They still become all-stars. They still win championships. And so it doesn't matter what it is that you're chasing. There is a different way to go about the notoriety. And so when I thought about, well, I could pay money to go racing. I could, you know, do these things, do these big expensive rallies, whatever it is that people were doing. But really, I thought, you know, if I could prove that I know how to solve a problem, I know how to build a car, I know how to drive a car, and I know how to do it safely and manage risks, that's kind of all the things that I want the world to know I'm good at. And this challenge just happens to encapsulate all of that.
Yeah.
And then throughout the course of my planning and thoughts about what this might look like, obviously a lot of things happen, including I see Alex Roy and Dave Maher set the record. I see Richie Rawlings and Dennis Collins make their claim as well. And, you know, it's just one of those things that the world gets kind of shook up. And I was really, you know, it felt like now I don't even know if I'm even up to it. I mean, these guys have all the money in the whole wide world, and I'm a college student. And so, you know, it took me a while, but it was one of those kind of ever dripping faucets in the background of my life that you never really entirely forget about, but you know, sometimes block out or ignore. And so eventually, yeah, in 2013, I was able to do it. And we set the record at 28 hours and 50 minutes.
That's awesome, man. How you got there, basically, to be able to set that record from just your dad telling you, hey, oh yeah, a cannonball. And then you going through all of this in your head, planning it out, basically designing what you wanted to do to be able to then accomplish that record. That's amazing, man. And I know you probably get asked about it so many times, and you've probably talked it to death, but I appreciate you sharing that once again for somebody to hear, because that really like shows like perseverance and planning and executing to the fullest, you know, to be able to accomplish your goal. So that's amazing, man.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, man. And I know we're getting kind of short on time, and I want to be respectful of your time. We have some fast lap questions that I want to get through. These are some just quick questions that I like to ask all my guests. So I think I know some of the answers to some of these questions, but I will ask it either way. What was that one car that impacted you the most in your life?
That's a great question. I mean, the first time that I saw the Road and Track article with the Nardo speed testing and the record setting of the Lamborghini Murcielago in 2001, where they set the fastest 100 miles, fastest 100 kilometers, and the furthest distance driven in an hour, that was just earth-shattering to me. I just thought the car was so, so, so cool. And, you know, certainly that became the goal. And that was certainly it. But, you know, there's other cars. There's the Yates Gurney Daytona that they drove and won the first Cannonball in November of 1971. I've done everything in my power to try to buy that car, and very unsuccessfully so far. But hey, you know, it happens. And so, you know, but to me, the Mercy was always a dream car. And I'm very, very, very happy to say that the one I have is sort of the perfect manifestation of that car for me.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I kind of thought you were going to go that route because I know you're such a Murcielago enthusiast. I just wanted to know which one kind of sparked that interest in you. So thank you for sharing that, man.
Sure thing.
All right, so kind of like a follow-up question to that. Now, I know you have an amazing garage. I even saw the Obsessed Garage build that they did for you. So you have an amazing garage already. But let's kind of take it back to you are just able to have a 3-car garage. That's it. Only cars you can have. No other cars. And these are your cars for the rest of your life. What cars would be in those 3 spots?
That's a great question. It'd be my LP640, a running version of the El Chapo McLaren F1, and the latest, greatest AMG S-Class that I could buy.
Oh, wow. Wow, Ed, that was the fastest answer to that question that I have ever gotten. Seems like you've been thinking about this. or at least a 3-car garage or
yeah, for sure. I mean, I think those are the cars. I mean, a McLaren F1 in some form is certainly the ultimate car. And I've been chasing the car that was owned by El Chapo's biggest drug runner, that's buried somewhere in Mexico in a ridiculous color combination of metallic brown with a red interior and gold wheels.
All right.
To sell me information about that car this afternoon. So I don't know if it'll ever be dug out of his son's hands, but I would love to own that one or any McLaren F1. And yeah, I mean, nothing would really replace my Mercy in terms of how much I love it. Maybe I could have a nicer one, but I mean, mine's great. But then you got to have something to just go places if you're only going to have a 3-car garage. And the best car by that approximation is biggest, baddest, latest, greatest AMG S-Class.
Nice. I would definitely like that 3-car garage. Sounds like it'll be a blast to drive those 3 cars. So thank you for that. Now that gets us to our last questions. Now, have you ever played Track Daily Crush?
No. What is that?
So,
which car would I track? Which car would I daily? And which car would I crush?
Yeah, basically. That's basically it. Analog
there. Go right ahead.
Yeah. I like how you deciphered that. So I'm going to give you a list of 3 cars. And just like you said, you're going to let me know which one of them you're going to daily drive, which one of them you're going to track, which one of them you're going to send to the junkyard to get crushed.
Sure.
So your list of cars, and I got to make it kind of difficult for all my guests, or at least I think I make it difficult. So your list is your LP640. We're going to go with the McLaren F1. And I was kind of on the fence about the third one. But I think we're going to go with that Daytona that you were talking about earlier that you would love to get. So track daily crush, Ed.
So I have to crush one of my 3 favorite cars?
Yes. And
I got to crush the Daytona because if I can't have it, then nobody can. And it's also one I've been told more repeatedly that I'm not allowed to buy.
Oh, okay.
I would track the McLaren because it's a little more expensive to maintain, which makes the LP640 the perfect daily.
So I got to tell you, those were the fastest answers that I got to those questions out of everybody that I asked. Well, but they were such great answers, though. I will tell you that.
I'm flattered.
Awesome, man. So thank you for playing. That is some good info. And I love knowing a little bit more about like somebody's car taste, which you shared a lot with our audience. So thank you for that. We're kind of nearing the end, towards the end of the interview. So I did want to kind of jump back into VinWiki, you know, and kind of like I'll go through kind of like a 2-part question. So you mentioned earlier that there were a lot of the idea sparked out of you actually putting your VIN numbers of cars that you've owned on your website. You met with your friends, a lot of pizzas, a lot of beer, a lot of coffee shops to come up with this idea. along with obviously the VinWiki stories. But how was it to go from being, you know, number one car salesman in exotic cars to then delving into this world, which you already kind of, you already had experience in being an entrepreneur, but just leaving that again, that like paycheck from somebody that's paying you, to then diving into this and being like, okay, we're going to make this happen. VinWiki is the future and it's no holds bar. Let's go straight into it.
So it didn't happen like that. As you might imagine, I had had my fill of the world of exotic car sales long before I left, and I knew that that was not my career path.
Okay.
And so I was looking for what was next, and quite honestly, I felt like I had a job lined up to run leasing for Porsche Financial for their Bentley, Lamborghini, and Bugatti products, and it was a massive pay cut. But it was a real job, like normal hours, like quality of life, like sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it ended up that the baggage from the Cannonball record kind of clouded over me. And that combined with their non-belief that I was okay taking the pay cut that it involved, meant that the job that I thought was there when I left wasn't. And that was okay. It was for the best, certainly, because that would have just been, you know, another distraction of a few years figuring out that that was also not something I wanted to do for a long term. But at the time, I had a young kid, and it was just something I didn't want to work 80 hours a week. So I didn't leave knowing what was next. Okay. And when I figured out that my friends, collectively, we could build VinWiki, and I could work to market VinWiki and brand VinWiki, the app, I also never thought that was going to be my full-time job. However, it started to get enough traction and require enough of my time that it wasn't easy for me to go find whatever else might have been next. And so, again, very much by accident and sort of there not being anybody else to kind of push that forward, I became the guy at the front of VinWiki trying to push it. And so when that worked, kind of, we needed it to work better. And so that's where the social media push and that's where the YouTube channel came from. And it took probably, you know, several months before it made any money whatsoever, even got monetized, much less was successful. But I mean, I remember the day we made $100 and I was like, holy cow, like we just made more than poverty on the internet making car videos. How about that? And it started to seem like on some trajectory, this could be my job. But I had gone at that point 2 years without making a dollar.
Wow.
Apart from the roof flip, which I did make, I made good money on that. But I mean, that wasn't real. It's just one thing that you put back in the savings that you're bleeding out. And so it wasn't like, this is where I'm at, that's the idea, full steam ahead towards that, because there wasn't clarity of what the idea was. And there wasn't a goal. Like, I didn't sit there at my desk at the dealership thinking that, you know, 5 years from now, I want to be the kind of guy that strangers call me to be on their podcast because I've achieved something. Like, that's not it. And it's still not that. Like, that part of it is really, really strange and unintentional and, you know, not unwelcome, but surprising, because like I didn't intend to be an influencer. I didn't set the Cannonball record for anything to do with anybody else. Yeah. I did it because it was a goal that defined who I wanted to be for me. And that if I did it, I would have become who I wanted to be with respect to the automobile, not with respect to the world of automobile enthusiasts. And so, you know, my hope for my kids, my hope for my friends, my hope for anybody listening to this is that they can find that thing that expresses who they want to be much more than who they want to impress. And anybody who is who they want to be is impressive. I don't care what you're good at. I don't care what you chase. I don't care what your goals are. If you do it, regardless of what I think about those goals with respect to my life, that doesn't mean anything. I care. I'm impressed. I am happy to co-celebrate that kind of achievement when somebody not only identifies what they want to be and what they want to do, but they achieve it and they live through that journey. And that's what I feel proudest to celebrate about myself, is that I figured out what it was with respect to my time here on earth and my time as a God-created person with the gifts that he bestowed on me in the world and the context that we find ourselves in, that I found something that could be those things for me. And it gave me the stories to tell. And since then, I've gotten a whole lot of miles out of those stories. And I'm very, very happy about that. But at the same time, all of the benefit, all of the realization, all of the catharsis of that journey didn't happen in the years to follow. It happened in that moment, tears coming down my face, looking out at the Pacific Ocean at the pier at the Portofino.
And I get it. Like, you didn't set out to be an influencer. You didn't set out to basically intentionally be where you are right now. It just happened just off of you wanting to do this for yourself or having goals for yourself. So that's amazing, man. And that just goes to show everybody that, like you just said, like, it's not to go out there to impress somebody. It's not to go out there to, do stuff for other people. It's doing things for yourself. And like you mentioned earlier, finding what that is that you want to be, what that is that you want to do, and just do the best at it. So thank you for that, man. That's I have to say that I put like what I call words of wisdom at the beginning of every episode, and it's gonna be pretty hard to to pick a 20-second, 30-second clip from this episode. So that was great, man. Thank you. And I really like how you put that, because it really shows the struggle. People just think that starting a business or even getting into the car industry with a business or whatever, it's just all fun and games. You're going to be an overnight success. It's like they say, nobody just becomes successful overnight, because although you're just seeing them right now in the limelight, you haven't seen the hours of work that they've put in behind the scenes. So that just goes to show that right there. So thanks for that, Ed.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for giving me the chance to say it.
No problem, man. So real quick, man, I know it went on a little bit longer. Again, I'm sorry. I definitely want to be respectful of your time. But what's next for VinWiki? What's next for Ed Bolian? What do we have? What can we be expecting?
Well, the great thing about finding those things that you want to do is that it creates opportunities that you never would have expected. And so even though no part of the VinWiki lifespan has been planned, it has opened up so many doors and built so many relationships that I never could have anticipated or planned. And the most significant of those has honestly become the relationship with Freddie Tavares Hernandez and Tyler Hoover that allowed us to start Car Trek.
Yes.
Because if you think about, like I said, when I was a kid, I wanted to be the crocodile hunter. And then very quickly after that, I thought that what these guys got to do on Top Gear was the fantasy of anyone who has ever started the right car and had themselves feel a certain way. And so when we collectively built an audience that allowed us to build sponsor relationships to kind of do whatever we want, if a sponsor asks you, if you could do whatever you want, what would it be? It would be Car Trek. It's going out and playing Top Gear in cars that you have a true stake in, that you decide you want. And we've been so fortunate to do, now we're releasing right now for our fourth series, and we're about to go out and shoot our fifth. And that is as much fun as I can have doing anything that could ever be called work. And it's one of those things that I would more than happily do any day of the week without a camera there. But the idea that we get to take people along on the journey vicariously is the coolest thing in the world. And that we get to see their feedback through the comments and through the viewership is so cool, because we are expressing our love for cars within the confines of a challenge that we create alongside Auto Tempest, the sponsor of the series. And then we go on some epic adventure in these cars that inevitably results in challenges and hardship and difficulty, but also a celebratory achievement and victory. And I call it, we get to play Top Gear, because that is exactly what we do. And I'm not apologetic about the fact that it's in the vein and in the style of things that we've loved about them. I mean, certainly it differentiates because we actually do buy the cars with our real money. Auto Tempest is helping with the production, but they're not paying for our vehicles. But at the same time, it is what we would be doing anyway. And 2 years ago, I sat around my fireplace with Freddie talking about YouTube strategy and what we'd learned and ideas. And I just said to him, dude, why don't we just play Top Gear? Why don't we do a cheap car challenge? And he's like, oh, we can't do that. I said, why can't we? We have sponsors ask us all the time, like, what kind of content do you want to produce? I want to make Top Gear style stuff. And they're like, well, it costs a lot more. Okay, how much does it cost? Can we do it? And it became, all right, well, this is really how much it costs. We figured out that. And it's not the same thing. It's not $2 million an episode. I can tell you that. It's not 1% of that. But at the same time, it has become the most fun that I have each year. And I'm so blessed to have been able to do that. And I feel like as we accumulate any kind of viewership, any kind of audience, any kind of opportunities, we owe it back to those viewers, to those people who, you know, aspire to do things we've done, to up the production quality, to up the ante every time we can. And Car Trek, quite honestly, is that. It is us building the best content we're capable of with people who are better at their jobs than we could ever be, and living out the exact manifestation of whatever dream we have with respect to cars. And if we're going to be proper stewards of the attention of our audiences, I think that's the only possible thing that we could deduce as being our responsibility. And the fact that it is both, I think, the right thing to do when people want to watch, and the most fun thing I could do if somebody said, you can do anything you want tomorrow, has been really, really cool for there to be an intersection there.
Yeah, man, definitely. And I know we didn't get into Car Trek because there's so much to talk about, man. I know we have a limited space or a limited time, but thank you for bringing that up, kind of letting us know a little bit more about that. And I know if you guys have not been watching the series, like Ed said, season 4 is on YouTube right now. It's on Tavarish's channel, right, Ed? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we release it there because he releases videos a lot less consistently, and so it ends up working a lot better for different content styles, so it's perfect.
I believe episode 3 came out today, right?
It did, yeah. When are you going to release this podcast?
This will be out in about 2 weeks.
Okay, so at that point, all 5 episodes of Series 4 will be out. And so that premise was that we had to find the coolest Ferrari that we could for the price of a Toyota Camry. And so we ended up with a Ferrari 308 GTB for Freddie, absolute piece of garbage, and a 456 GT for Tyler, a beautiful car, but very much a grandpa version of a Ferrari. And I ended up trading a Lamborghini Diablo that I had bought for $78,000, which is a fraction of what a Lamborghini Diablo should be worth, because it was a fraction of what a nice Lamborghini Diablo would be. But I was able to trade that, get 38 grand back, and get a 599, which in my books makes that $40,000. On the dealer's side, it was probably 80, let's be honest. But yeah. I have a $40,000 599. And that's the car that I participated in. It was by far not a perfect 599 because it spent a considerable portion of its life, much more than it should have, under about 40 inches of water.
And so
you love those flood cars, man. I remember the blue Lamborghini. Steel.
They're a great deal. Absolutely. I've been driving that, and we're still struggling a bit with the airbag light, but overall it is a great automobile. And so, yeah, by the time this comes out, we'll actually be in the process of filming Car Trek 5, which is going to be a bit of an ode to our personal dream cars. And so I'll be pulling the LP640 out, and the other guys will have theirs, and we'll make a series out of it.
That's awesome, man. I love this series, man. I watch every season, or I've watched every season. I know you guys put it out. Is it like every other day that you guys put it out? Because I remember just watching episode 2, like either yesterday or the day before.
Yeah, so we've done it different ways because we don't know what we're doing. And we are doing this because it's somebody told us we could. So we did Monday, Wednesday, Friday so far. I'm actually not sure yet if we're going to do Sunday or Monday for episode 4. And then it'll be a couple of days later for episode 5. So we did 5 days leading up to Christmas for our Christmas special series, which was Secret Santa style, giving each other the most unreliable cars on earth. I really enjoyed that series. And then we did them a little bit. I think we did every other day for the second one, which was who could find the most appreciated supercar on earth. And then the first one was who could buy the coolest car for the price of a C8 Corvette. And I think that was all over the place. I mean, I think we went a week between episodes at one point because we were doing a lot more of the editing internally and it was a mess. But it's very different producing, you know, more of a television show type episode than our normal YouTube content.
Nah, man. And the series is great, man. I can tell you that one thing that I do hate about the series is that every time I watch one of the episodes, I'm on Auto Tempest or even on Carfax, and I'm looking to see how cheap I can get a supercar for.
There you go, man.
I've gone back and forth between like Aston Martins, Gallardos, I think maybe a Maserati at one point. I'm like, oh man, I'm like, this is not good for my wallet. My wife is going to kill me.
There you go. Well, you just got to have the right car at the right when. And, you know, I've counseled a whole lot of people through that idea of like, what car can I buy that I want, but that also my wife won't hate me for owning. And that's a fun thing. I mean, I've seen every end of that spectrum, but you know, as long as you buy a car that's a true expression of why you like cars, that isn't you being beheld to somebody else telling you that that's what the best car is. And as long as you buy it in a financially responsible enough way, you can finance them for forever. And you can end up with a great payment and a great outcome and a great opportunity to own one of your cars. I mean, I've owned 40 plus. I don't know how many I've owned at this point, but I don't think I've ever lost money on one. Yeah. And so it's one of those things where if you learn enough about the cars and you know how to buy them the right way, I'm not saying that I beat the market if I tied up the same down payment money, but I am saying that I didn't lose money the same way people lose money when they go buy a new FRS.
Oh, yeah.
Like cheap cars are really expensive to own from a depreciative standpoint. But when you buy something that's actually your dream car or something that you can truly love and enjoy, most of them on a modern basis are unlikely to give you some catastrophic service bill. So it's pretty easy to make a logic around what you want to do. It's just a matter of finding the right car and having the right amount of fun.
Yeah. And the thing that gets you is that initial payment at the beginning, like that, that 60, 70, 80,000 for, I don't know, a used Gallardo R8 or something like that is what kills you at the beginning. But you are right. At the end of the day, you're probably going to get that money back when you go to trade it in. Probably.
So my original plan with Car Trek was an FF.
Oh,
because when we first thought about this Ferraris for the price of a Camry idea, I saw that. I went out and did a lease quote at Toyota.com, And it was like $568 for a month for this lease. And I'm like, you know, at that time you could buy FF for 80 grand with some miles, like a 12. And I was like, it's not going to depreciate that much. I could get a company like Premier Financial Services, which does these closed-ended leases where you are, theirs are open-ended leases. So you have to refinance it at the end, but it's fine. And they'll set a residual probably at maybe $70,000. So I'm only paying down the principal between that spread. So if it's a $70,000 residual and an $80,000, $85,000 purchase price, you know, I'm over 5 years, I'm only paying down 10 grand in principal. Now I got some interest there, but you can get a payment of $550, $600.
Yeah.
And so, and that's what I loved about the dealership world was that I got to show people that for what you're paying now, with the way that you can finance these older but not depreciating cars, you can own what you want and end up in much better shape, because it's not like your Civic Type R is not depreciating. It's a great car. It's got good residual value. It's doing well. But at the same time, it can't be that stable. And it can't be stable like a 10-year-old exotic car can.
Yeah, no. And you're totally right. And I will say that everything you just said, I love it, but you lost me at the math. And that's where obviously your expertise comes in, and my horrible math skills kind of set me back.
Well, thank you so much for having me tonight. Good luck with the podcast growing, and I appreciate the questions.
Yeah, man, no problem. Thank you so much. Where can, just real quick, obviously VinWiki on YouTube, social media.
At Ed Bolian or at VinWiki. Sometimes it's at VinWiki _official. Car Trek on Tavares's channel. Anywhere you want to find me, I tend to be pretty easy to round up.
Perfect. So you guys heard it there. Definitely check out VinWiki. Check out Car Trek. And, you know, as you heard it here, Ed is a pretty cool dude. He's a really cool dude. Definitely hit him up if you need anything. Definitely connect with him. Check out VinWiki. And, you know, if you haven't seen those episodes of Car Trek, definitely get started and get on this season 4. Ed, thank you so much. And you have a great night, man.
You do the same. Thank you for having me. Motor Misfits.